If I'm just wondering if we could move past the issue of whether irrigation is clearance.
Yes.
We understand the submissions on that point. I think we've probably dealt with that sufficiently, and we can move on to the other aspects.
What I will do is simply alert you to paragraph 14 on page 4, because what I have done is attempted to find in the council staff section 32 analysis an acknowledgement that including the application of water in the definition of appearance of vegetation has a potential cost associated with it, at least from a farming point of view. I've appended the relevant extract of the section 32 report to my submissions and marked it with a very sophisticated piece of that 4.10. Because I wanted you to be aware that the cost of the addition to that definition either hasn't been assessed at all, or, and that seems to be from the analysis, seems to be what has happened. You can see that there is a recognition that the definition has been extended to include the deliberate application of water, but there's no recognition that that might have a cost associated with it. So that aspect of the change claim has to be assessed.
Will we be told what those costs are in terms of your...
Well, we are not first thing I say, but that is not our obligation to do so.
It helps us understand whether it's an issue or not.
Yes. Well, the purpose of this exercise, from our point of view, is to explain to you that from Jeremy Bell and Hesmith Limited's point of view, if there is to be a constraint over the ability to irrigate, in addition to regional council constraints, then that does have a potential cost. Now, exactly what that is very difficult to ascertain for reasons that Dr. Espy will explain, which is to say, how do the rules apply and where do they apply? Moving to my paragraphs 15 and 16, I'm mindful of your direction that you don't want counsel to repeat what witnesses have to say, so I'm not going to.
Was it directed at you, Mr. Payne?
No.
We did have one instance.
Directed at counsel generally, I'm sure.
We had two counsel present who asked for 3 hours, I think, so to hear from them and the witness. They took the 3 hours up. And then unfortunately the witness was supposed to be flying back to Auckland at about 20 minutes after the 3 hours had expired.
Yeah, I'm not even going to hazard a guess who it might
be. No, you don't need to.
Paragraph 17, again, this is something that Dr. Resby will develop, but I submit that there is a problem conceptually with the use of the lens classification system, in addition to that which Mandy has dealt with in her evidence. And that is, when you look at section 6C, the detection of habitats is in relation to the habitats of fauna, not the habitats of flora. The way that the lens classification seems to be used in the rules here is to treat it as an indication of habitat, because of course it doesn't tell you anything about what vegetation is actually present on any particular property, only that it's a habitat for vegetation that is deprived through previous development in ways not recently can explain further. So,
this is a page of it. If section 6 is about habitat protection for fauna only, what's the habitat that the fauna resides in?
Well, I don't know. The plan doesn't say.
I thought it was the Act. Sorry, are you referring to the lens classification or the Resource Management Act itself? Sorry, that's what I'm trying to understand.
Well, the starting point is section 6C. And the section that I want to draw to your attention is what is being protected. In relation to vegetation, it's significant that there's vegetation.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's significant habitat of indigenous fauna. Now, it seems to me that what LENS does is tell you where there is habitat for vegetation, not where there is significant vegetation actually existing. In fact, it almost does the reverse. It tells you where there is an absence of significant such as vegetation. So what I'm...
Dr. Hesby might be better to answer this.
Yes.
Can you actually have a habitat for vegetation?
No.
I didn't think you could. That's why I asked the question.
But if what we're trying to do here is to tell us what vegetation ought to be protected, the use of the LEMS classification seems to me as a surrogate, because it doesn't tell us where there is vegetation or where the vegetation is significant. It only tells you where it tends to be missing. So the point that we're trying to make in what Dr. Espy makes about that is that Section 6C in our submission doesn't lead to LENS being an obvious method to implement what that section is trying to achieve.
Is there any other classification system that does?
Well, the obvious example is the ECNA method, which this plan uses and which we support. It tells you where there is vegetation that is significant and warrants protection, and it does that by mapping that vegetation and having rules that apply.
Is it also mentioned that the identification of SNAs is complete?
Well, people can answer that from an ecology point of view.
Mm.
From a process point of view, I say that there is always the opportunity for the council to identify other areas that are significant. And if it wishes to do that, there is a process for it to go through. And that's a plan change. And the merits or otherwise of the protection of that vegetation will be examined and explored, and plans amended accordingly if need be. So I don't think we have to say we have to have that as a method which is wholly complete now. Like any plan, it is capable of amendment later on through a process of engagement with landowners, and that's a topic that Mandy will refer to in her evidence. And if there are areas which warrant further investigation. But I don't think you have to be satisfied that all of vegetation which could possibly be regarded as significant have to be scheduled now. If the council considers that there is an ongoing process to be followed, then they can do so. Because what we say is that the SNA program as a Section 60 method itself.
Are there any scenarios that have been identified through this plan on New Zealand's land?
On critical land? The nearest would be Luggage Creek. On either side of Luggage Creek there is an SCA in the plan.
But it's not on
New Zealand's land. It's on Lake Mackay Station.
Yeah, it's actually Lake Mackay. And Locker State.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just discussing this page, it occurs to me that, I don't know if you're aware, that we asked Mr. Barr to prepare some analysis of how the indigenous vegetation rules can apply, and he provided the memo to us this morning. Have you seen that?
No, I
haven't. Sam, have you? Get the copies of that possible. It just occurs to me before we ask Dr. Esty any questions, it might be useful for him to read that and look at the examples provided.
But I've certainly seen the 42A report and the discussion of the rules.
No, this is extra information that we asked for, having heard the other farmers in the other sector. Mm-hmm. And I apologise, I should have mentioned this before lunch, but I think it's...
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, if I hand that to Peter, in the meantime, do you want me to continue with my
Yes.
What I do now is move to the drafting of the rules themselves. Now, rather... drafting criticism from the Innes case has been helpfully removed. Credit be credited to you. But in my submission has been replaced by other sources of uncertainty and difficulty. Rules 33.3.2 and 3 are the first provisions that I want to refer to. Now, the question is, how can a threshold percentage of area to be cleared be sensibly understood in the context of competitive exclusion? If, for example, 100 hectares is put under a permit, what does the 20% of the area to be cleared refer to? Is it 20 hectares, i.e. 20% of the 100? Or does the rule only apply when more than 20% of the indigenous vegetation expected to be excluded exceeds the threshold in Table 2? I don't know the answer to that. I don't
know. That was my question.
But it's not the former, with respect, because the 20% reference in the rule explicitly refers to of the area to be cleared. So,
sorry, Alex might not be clear what it is. What do you think it should be?
Well, JBIL's position is that there shouldn't be a control on the clearance of indigenous vegetation outside of the SNA mapped areas and below the 1070 elevation. And I should add to that also the setback from the waterways. Mm. So we're not promoting an alternative drafting of the way that 3332 and 333 should work.
Mm.
What we're doing is drawing attention to the practical difficulties of the way they are drafted. Mm.
So, I take that point, but if you were going to draft it so that if it was to be included, from a legal perspective, how should it be formulated?
Well,
if we're taking it as the, if we're not taking it not as the first one, but as the second, it would be 20% of the area of indigenous vegetation. How would you structure that rule to achieve that?
If what you were saying that the rules only apply when more than 20% of the indigenous vegetation is to be cleared, then that would simplify the structure of the rule considerably. The trouble is that in the context of competitive exclusion, it's almost impossible to understand how you would know whether the threshold is going to be met or not.
So that part there would remain even if you simplify
that. That problem would remain, yes. Now, remembering that 33.3.2 deals with where you have structural dominance. 33.3.3 is the rule which deals with where you don't. And so the threshold there is 30%. And so the difficulty there is how one sensibly calculates whether tiny species such as moss, the non-vascular ones, or seasonal species such as were at large in the Innes case, contribute to the total area to be cleared. And if there are a seasonal component there, does one do the calculation in autumn, or in the winter, or in the spring? Or can it only be done at certain times of the year, or is it any particular day? This is an enormous practical difficulty for any farmer to say, do I require a consent, because does the rule apply?
Just the way that the rule is worded, with the clearance involves 30% indigenous. And the definition of clearance would the any landowner be given the definition of clearance be clearing other areas apart from indigenous vegetation?
No.
So in fact the 30% is the area that's been cleared, not... So the 100% is indigenous. I'm just having difficulty with understanding how the rule practically applies, because what you're clearing, essentially attempting to clear, is indigenous vegetation which is inappropriate for the farm. You're not clearing other things, but the rule seems to suggest that there is a bigger area that has been cleared.
Yes.
And does that create a fundamental problem as well?
Well, it does, because the ratios don't match the way the definitions work.
Mm. That might even be more fatal than just the suggestion.
Well, it's a bit like the Innes case, which is that the more you think about how the rules work, the more it makes you head hurt.
Mm.
And I can't promise that in my submissions that I've identified all of the problems, but these are just the ones that immediately occur to me as a practitioner. Things that might occur to Mandy is for someone who has to operate with these things, or to Peter, who's someone who has to advise on it. There may be a whole new suite of difficulties that I haven't thought of. Now, then there's a further complication with both of those rules, because they both have disjunctive clauses. if you look at 33.3.3, they both end with a clause which says, or total number of species present of the total area to be cleared. So not only do we have an area percentage threshold, we've also got a species diversity threshold. And again, when you try and think about this from the point of view of somebody who wishes to put a paddock under irrigation, how are we to understand whether 30% of the total number of species present to be cleared, how does that threshold work? Now, if we've got a pasture system which happens to have remnant indigenous species in it, then the chances are that indigenous vegetation species, as a number of them, will occupy all but one or two of the total number of species, because the rest will be the introduced pasture grasses that are deliberately used from the point of view.
The stroke of power at the end where or total, how does that relate? Does the or only relate to the indigenous vegetation exceeds? It's just a bit about structural dominance that's at the front part of that rule. Is it and, if you like, and A or B, or is it structural dominance and exceeds the 20%?
Well,
or
it's fiendishly difficult, but if the word or is to be taken seriously, then we have two independent clauses in that paragraph, in each of those rules. We've got, let's take 33.3.3, so that's this is, and exceeds 30% of the total area to be cleared, or total number of species of the total area to be cleared. Now, I'm trying to make sense of that by saying that the 30% threshold applies to both.
That one's got a comma and the one above it does not.
Well, there's another point.
Yeah. I'm just trying to read.
I can't help you with why that's... I really can't.
I just... No. Yeah.
But, I mean, this is exactly the kind of analysis which, in an enforcement context, the Environment Court is going to have to go through. Now, how on earth a landowner can know how these rules apply within an existing farming system?
This would apply, my understanding, the reason is that regardless of whether you're doing it as irrigation or not, because
yes,
it's relating to vegetation clearance,
yes,
the potential issues apply, in all,
yes,
regardless of the method of clearance.
They do. I mean, the rules probably work if you are dealing with a large specimen that has structural dominance, like Kānuka, residual standard Kānuka in the corner of a paddock or something like that.
And you use a chainsaw.
Yeah. And I can see how that they would work in that context, and it would be relatively uncontroversial. But that's not the situation that Innes was faced with, nor the situation that farmers in JVIL's position will be in when they come to redesign their irrigation systems at the behest of the Otago Regional Council and they renew their water rights. They've got to decide, do we require a resource consent from the Queensland Lakes District Council to run spray on these paddocks that we've been farming for the last 100 years? And the short answer is, we've got no idea.
Well, and ignoring the issue of irrigation, how would these rules apply if you were cultivating the land?
Well, the same problem arises. I mean, the what's being killed off and what's not being killed off becomes rather clearer, probably, because if you're, because the effect of cultivation is probably easier to assess. I mean, Peter might say that I'm quite wrong about that. But at least you know what parts of the land are being turned over. But how you decide how the two thresholds work, the percentage of the total area to be cleared when you're dealing with tiny little plants sitting below the pasture system, or you're dealing with a threshold number of species present and the proportion of those. It's beyond me how you would deal with that forensically. So this is the point I've been trying to make. Yes, some of the problems that that the court in the Innes case was dealing with the drafting have been fixed, and hooray for that, but we've replaced them with a bunch of new problems which are equally intractable. And this is what's led us to the solution, which is to say, and I know that my friend Mr. Winchester criticised me for not providing a solution to the drafting problems, but we're saying there isn't a solution to the drafting problems in those rules. Keep it simple. Identify the stuff that's significant, draw a line around it so everyone knows where it is. Identify the areas that you want to protect above 1070 beside rivers. That's great, do all that. Everybody knows where they are and what they are. The rest of it, you don't have to deal with it. So that brings me to my paragraph 23. Rule 33.5.6 suffers similar problems as in the Innes case. Many of the scheduled species are tiny, cryptic, and utterly invisible to all the expert eyes. Liability is strict under the Resource Management Act. Knowledge and intention are irrelevant. So the council puts its citizens in jeopardy of criminal sanction. The host council will be clear about where the rules apply and where they don't. The SNA rules should that, but rule 33.5.6 does not. It is with respect to minefield.
In terms of the knowledge and intention regarding strict liability, from the legal point of view, the definition I was asking earlier about where it said about the deliberate in terms of the definition?
Yes.
How do those two things work together?
Well, I saw that as it's the application of the water that's the deliberate part about it.
But it's for the effects.
It would be almost impossible in my submission to run a defence on the basis that irrigation was not a deliberate strategy to allow introduced species a competitive advantage over everything else that was there.
And that competitive advantage would therefore be the clearance of vegetation.
Yes. I cannot imagine a plausible defence on the basis that yes, we put this area around the pivot, yes, we sowed it with introduced species, but didn't mean to cause those species to outcompete others.
If you've been pivot irrigating for a long time and these species came back, whatever, and were identified and turned it on again, then the same.
If the present indigenous species were shown to have happily survived irrigation, then it seems to me that you haven't breached the law of mini caps, because you haven't cleared it, whether you intended to or not. But the point I want to make is that under the Act, liability for offences, for breaching rules are strict. It's not like theft, we've intended to deprive somebody of something. There's no mental element. If you've done it, you've done it. And so when people in Mandy's position, when you've got tiny little animal critters, plants, that they don't know about, just as in the Innes case, but yet you've got criminal sanctions for breaching rules for carrying things that you didn't know were there and couldn't have known were there and the council didn't know were there, that's an unsatisfactory set of circumstances in my solution. And that brought me to my reference to an old case, Sanderson and Chain, from 1986 in the Court of Appeal, where the Court of Appeal said it is desirable that those who administer or are affected by or have to advise on the restrictions prescribed by a town planning ordinance should be able to identify without difficulty the properties to which it relates. Now, that, in my submission, is as sound now as it was then, and that is the problem with much of the indigenous vegetation rules. No one can tell us where they apply and where they don't. Not a problem, you've got SNAs, that's fine, you know where they are, they're maps, they've been tested. And that really was the fundamental failure in Innes. Yes, the way that indigenous vegetation was defined and the way the rules were problematic, and the court explained that. But the real problem was that Mr. Innes didn't know about the vegetation at Miles property. He went and asked the council didn't know about the vegetation on the property. A third party then came onto the property at some late stage and found something and didn't bother to tell the landowner, and yet the cultivation took place and the enforcement proceedings were taken. From the landowner's point of view, that's a hopeless situation to have. You've got rules that apply in places that not even the landowner nor the council know about. And that's what we're asking you to fix. So those are my submissions.
In the synopsis submissions, you refer to the draft NPS for biodiversity. What's the status of that document?
The hearings have been held, decisions haven't been released.
When were the hearings held?
Late last year. As at last night, the Otago Regional Council's website predicts that decisions will be released in September.
Sorry, are we talking about the...
No, that's the RPS.
I think, yeah.
I'm sorry.
National Policy Statement on Biodiversity.
Oh, I beg your pardon, I'm sorry, I was... Yeah, I misunderstood. The Biodiversity NPS has been parked, as far as I know.
Yeah. So, is it sitting, does it have any official status?
No.
No official statement?
No, the Act doesn't require you to take into account draft NPSs and improvements.
And proposals?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know anything about why the Minister is sitting on the on that NPS. Any of these website doesn't tell me.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any commissioners have any questions?
Just page, if I could just take you back to page 5 of your submission. The discussion around the difficulty of applying the percentage tests and rules 33.3 and 33.2 and the following one. Does that become easier if you're in a more proactive situation, for example, of planning some vegetation clearance deliberately versus the irrigation, which might have an uncertain outcome?
The problem identify about what's the 100% that you're calculating the 20% of still exists. The problem is easier if you know what the vegetation is and where it is. And as you say, you are deliberately designing a scheme to remove it. Yes, that is easier. And I guess it's a little bit like in this, in which that there are circumstances in which the rule can work. But what we're saying is that there are significant circumstances in which the rule is completely unclear about how it will work, and that's the problem.
So I think your response to that initially was that you can't see a way that you could forensically apply that test, which I guess is not your issue because you're the lawyer and not the psychologist. So the question for Dr. Estee would be, can you see a way that you could design an experiment for a test to apply those percentages? If you were given open license to undertake an ecological assessment of a pasture, for example, and to assess what species are there, what percentage might be affected by changing an irrigation ratio.
Yeah, Peter should answer that, but can I just say something before he does? The reference to a forensic test is an after-the-fact reconstruction of what happened, as opposed to a predictive process.
Okay.
So, in an enforcement context, which is what farmers worry about, how would you be able to show that you either did or didn't comply with the rule afterwards? Which is how enforcement processes work. And so that is, should we plow the paddock? Did we breach the rule or not? We have no idea. Can it be used in a predictive way that Peter can ask that part of you?
I'll answer that in my preset in maintenance.
Thank you. I think we've got probably exhausted.
Yes, so Peter's going next, and he has prepared a 2-page summary as the directions of this tonight, which will preface whatever questions that you may want to ask of him. Yeah. So, I presume what Peter says about his qualifications can be taken as read, and that he can read straight to his summary?
Yes, we've read his statement in advance, so we can read straight to the summary. Thank you.
I think I'm the only ecologist in the country that has aroused the ire of both the farming community and some of our NGOs. When we did the Protected Natural Areas Survey of the Mackenzie Basin, that was received with what could be described as polite hostility from the farming community. And some of the research I've done subsequently into dryland ecosystems and the implications of the underlying science that addresses conservation management of native indigenous systems has aroused the ire of some of our environmental NGOs. I come to this hearing with a very deep commitment not to a partisan position, but rather as in the Environment Board laws or that as an expert witness to provide evidence that will help you in making decisions about how we manage in Queenstown this issue. I've been involved with some of the contentious issues in Queenstown Lakes. Vegetation clearance, the Innes case, the Fiske case, and in a wider sense, the Minaret case, with tenure review, and providing scientific evidence that helps clarify people making decisions and the next context and that capability I come here today. What we're facing is a difficult issue because we've got two conflicting demands. On one hand, we've got the statutory requirement to protect indigenous vegetation, and on the other, we've got farming as a permitted activity. And the issue in which they conflict is in fact on the dryland, outwash and basin floor ecosystems. Now that's undisputed. And what the role of government is, in my opinion, is to stand aside from the arguments advocated by special interest groups and to try and find a path that is equitable, it's balanced and reasonable, and above all, that can attain to community assent and buy-in. Now, I'd like to note that I'm a scientist, I'm neither a lawyer nor a district planner, and so bear with me when I present how I see things. The first and most important conclusion that I reached from carefully reading all of the evidence is that the proposed amendments in the QLDC vegetation clearance plan will not achieve its objective. It will fail. It's simply redrafting the same concepts with modifications in the presence of innocent Fiske. It does not address the fundamental issues that gave rise to those cases. And if we don't, as a community, come up with a new and better way of addressing those, we will face further legal challenges. It's an unproductive use of council resources and community resources. The problems that underlie the whole of the construction of the vegetation clearance rules in the Queenstown Lakes District Plan are based on some fundamental and deeply significant flaws. They're not trivial issues that I address in my evidence, and they're not trivial issues that we address now. The first and most important issue is that it relies heavily on using surrogate indices to determine value for indigenous vegetation and not actual determinants. The second issue is prevalent in the district plan itself, and that's an inadequate definition of what's meant by indigenous vegetation. And the third issue is that it fails conspicuously to consider the adequacy of protection in determination of application of vegetation clearance rules. Now, I'll speak briefly to the above points and make some points that I think may be helpful for a way forward. The first and most important thing is that in determination of the values of indigenous vegetation or rare species, single species classification, and they're very different, the primary criterion must be and can only be the characteristics of the vegetation itself. That is the key attributes on which decision and assessment of value must rest. The definitions in the Queenstown Lake District Plan, I think, are good. They refer to structure, dominance, species composition, naturalness, etc. And I think that those in their entirety, as in the district plan, are workable and helpful. Now that might seem a contradiction to what I've just said, but I'll elaborate. Before we go further, I'd like to make one point that I think, again, is very important. That is the inclusion of that deceptively simple word, or, in Glenn Davis's evidence, it's in his point 7.7 in Forest and Bird Raiser. The background to that was raised in the Innes case of determining what's a vegetation community. The judge rejected the exclusion of the word or in that case, because when you're looking at a vegetation community, to determine significance, you look at all of its attributes together. To use an example, if you wish to define me as a person, I'm a total person, and you can't define me by lopping off a leg and saying that stands alone, or the other leg, or an arm. It's the combination of all those attributes that define you. So, the combination of structure, species composition, and dominance must be held together, and to replace those with single factor assessments, say only structure, or only species composition, or only dominance is sufficient to define indigenous vegetation, is a fundamental mistake, and therefore should not be permitted to continue on in the district plan. As an example of this in relation to vegetation, we've got another example of a surrogate indices that's been used to determine vegetation clearance. And I just refer briefly to that of using the centre pivot with competitive exclusion as being a mechanism that we should mandatory include as a way of protecting our indigenous vegetation. Once again, that argument is using the surrogate indices, which is the centre pivot, and it avoids the fundamental question of what is the vegetation on that site where pivot irrigation is proposed. We need to look at the fundamental, not the secondary. So we should look at the condition of the vegetation that's on that site and ascertain that against ecological values to determine significance, and then from that make a decision regarding land use. I only use that as an example. Secondly, I think we need to have a very clear and simple definition of what indigenous vegetation is. It's understood by everybody. That was the clear ruling from the judge in this case. And in my evidence in section 3.5, I provide something that I think might be helpful. If you look at that simply and logically, if we have a vegetation community, which is assemblage of plant communities, where, in terms of simplifying things just to those three components, it's predominantly composed of the structural tier of indigenous species, the biodiversity of vascular species components, indigenously predominantly comprised of indigenous species, and the cover is also comprised of dominant indigenous species. Very few people have any problem with recognising that as indigenous vegetation. So that, in my diagram, is community 1 in red. Conversely, if you look at community 5 on my diagram, which is printed in blue, you've got the reverse. If you've got an introduced pasture, say, that's 100% or very high in cover, structure, species composition of exotic species, few people have any problem with recognising that as an exotic community. But the problem comes when we deal with the in-between. What do we do with the mixture of both? And in the vegetation clearance rules in section 33.3.1, it adopts a criterion of 80% of being indigenous and 20% 80% can be exotic and 20% can be indigenous, and that community is defined as being indigenous vegetation. Now, I would suggest that's a very conservative criterion. If we look at a simple three-way classification, and you accept that there is going to be some variation within the arbitrary and artificial classes that we erect, the class that we call indigenous vegetation, if we adopted a three-part partition, a 33% carbon structure dominance, like I argued, as being indigenous, the middle of 66 to 33 we designate as modified semi-natural, and the third class of 33 to 0% in terms of those three together we designate as exotic. That would considerably help frame the debate about what is and what isn't significant indigenous vegetation. In my evidence I've outlined the different viewpoints on that within the ecological community. One viewpoint is that indigenous vegetation is indigenous if it's derived from an indigenous source, irrespective of the degree of modification. I think that that has given rise to considerable confusion. And clarification of that would considerably assist interpretation of what is meant under the legislative requirements the council faces. I think that the three classes have got different requirements in terms of assessment of value. Those that are truly indigenous vegetation, let's say for the sake of the argument we run with my proposed classification, are essential to be protected under all costs in the Queensland Acres for Family. We need representative examples to protect the biodiversity in this district, and they require stringent protection and identification. When we come to the second class of the intermediate or modified vegetation, they should be assessed to see whether they will fit those requirements, but their criteria of acceptance will be different than the criteria by which they should be judged. Should be different. And thirdly, when we get to classes of exotic vegetation, it still retains importance for assessment of the single species or rare or threatened species assessment, but it does not require protection in the same way as the first two classes. One of the most glaring omissions and fundamental weaknesses that underlie the proposed district plan concerns assessment of the adequacy of protection as a factor in looking at vegetation clearance. In my opinion, when we deal with the difficult and sometimes contentious issues of what should or should not be protected, we need to refer to the adequacy of what has already been protected in the district as against the actual values of the vegetation communities or the single species on that particular site. And in my evidence, you will see examples of how that's actually worked out in practice. Within us, we had the Queen Elizabeth II National Trust Covenant with Fescue Tussock Grassen, 60 odd hectares, directly on the boundary. We had Rekos Point Conservation Area of another 60 hectares of Manuka grass and shrubland across the river, which in my opinion adequately protected the values that were present on the other slant. In the hearing, people who adopted a different assessment of value, which they held to with integrity, completely ignored those. It was irrelevant. And that is precisely in the position that Glenn Davis adopts in his recommendations for implementation of the district plan, and it's been adopted by Alan Barr, who would rest his opinion on things. I think that we need to have a practical way forward. If you look at the Fiske case, it was precisely and exactly the same issues occurred. There was 2.3 hectares of kaimaka in a highly modified environment. Those who adopted the viewpoint that under the lens classification system and threatened environment classification system, any large remnant was important and should be protected, and that viewpoint is held, as I mentioned, with integrity, they ascribe high conservation value to those communities. The fact that Peter and Yvonne Fiske would give 6 hectares of a similar community directly adjoining the centre pivot of Kaimaka, and also good examples of Fiske Tussagrassi, is considered irrelevant. And we ended up in a hearing that involved a lot of council resources and a lot of farm resources. I think that, as you can see in my evidence, when you look at the amount of protected areas that were immediately adjoining the Fiske land, that was a factor that should be taken into consideration. If we do so, it does not negate the importance of assessing conservation values in what I call that little class of semi-modified vegetation. If, for example, there are no adequate communities in that immediate environment, we do not have means to define that for us, then that raises its conservation value or its requirement for protection. Conversely, if the community and the species it contains are widespread and protected in immediately adjacent areas, I would suggest that lowers the requirement for that particular community be protected and the consent should be granted for presence of indigenous vegetation. If we look at the actual amount of land that's protected, this is my second page of my evidence. In the Queensland Lake District plan, Queensland Lake District area, and this does not include QEZ covenants, this is simply Department of Conservation land, you'll see that an enormous amount of land is currently protected for conservation management.
Sorry, are you referring to the summary?
I'm referring to my speaking document here, sorry. In my primary evidence, I gave a detailed example of what's adjacent to the Fiske land, which is in Hawea Flat, and this is a much bigger picture of the district. Under the proposals before you for the district plan, that evidence is quietly removed and becomes irrelevant. The only thing that's determinative is if it occurs in a particular lens environment that's threatened. In my evidence, my primary evidence, I show you how in the Fiske case, you look at that and you find that, I think, fundamentally, is a completely fallacious and completely incorrect method of determining significance. Now that is precisely and exactly what Glenn Davis uses and what the council following his recommendations use for determining significance in treating things. The alternative is that we go back to the actual communities in the site and we assess them in that local area. I've outlined in my evidence, my primary evidence, some of the reasons why we should not and cannot use lens or the threatened environment, threatened species environments that are determined on it, to be used as a primary determinant of significance. And I speak to that as the manager of the Grow Otago modelling project, where we provided an alternative modelling for environments within the Otago region and built models and climate models for it. LENS is useful as a planning tool at a high level. But when we start to try and apply it at a detailed local level, at the level 500, and use that to drive the district plan, it is simply an inadequate tool that's been used wrongly and should be rejected. And I'm fully aware that should you support a run at that point, it means that we have to reject the current approach that's being put forward for the district plan. So it's not a trivial issue. I then, in the next page of my talking evidence, note the primary mechanism for protection and conservation values in the Queenstown Bay District has been through tenure review. Those are the areas or properties in Crown Pastoral Land that have been assessed by the Department of Conservation in the dark ones and the light symbols and those that are still to be assessed, so recent tenure review. And the outcome of that has been significant protection, and this is a critical point that was raised earlier, significant protection of all of the major communities that retain significant indigenous values or have potential to protect those through tenure review. And I think that it's an important provision that we should assess the areas remaining against that baseline. Second thing, you'll notice I mentioned single or rare species. We have two entirely different levels of scale and two entirely different sets of requirements that have been combined into one under that rubric of indigenous conservation. Single species management of indigenous species is an entirely different management, an entirely different assessment procedure than for communities. As Phil has pointed out, often these rare and threatened species are small, cryptic, and can only be identified by the expert. Point one. Point two, the management of those species is entirely different from communities. Now I'll give you an example. In the Mackenzie Basin, we have one of the nationally threatened species, a thing called New Zealand Meistertail, which is also present here in Meistertail's minimus. That species, one of the greatest populations of over 2,000 individuals in the Mackenzie, occurs on a dam that's excavated for irrigation. It loves the particular habitat that's been created there, and that's what it thrives. So the point I'm raising is that protection of that is very, very important under the district plan, and protection of those species is critical under the district plan. But it's an entirely different set of parameters in protection than for vegetation communities. And we can use small areas of active restoration within existing conservation areas to look at management of threatened indigenous species. Re-establishment of ecological restoration populations, for example. And the particular point that identification of these by ordinary farmers or ordinary people is almost impossible, and that's precisely the issue that Dougal Inn is facing. So we've got to find a way of being able to assist ordinary people, ordinary farmers, with how we can protect adequately those on their land. And what I would suggest is a way forward is that we use the work that Dean's done and the Council has done in putting forward the significant areas that he's proposing to look at. But instead of putting those down as a mandatory requirement and designating SLA and blocking on someone's land, we adopt a participatory approach that deeply involves the farming community of protection of the biodiversity that is present on their land, because this is private land. And I can only
say that from my involvement as a former director of the QC National Trust, that the farmers, far from being anti-conservationists, can be great allies in actually achieving conservation outcomes on their land. And I'm sure that Mandy will speak to this from her perspective as a farmer, that my involvement in nearly 30 years of conservation assessments in the South Island drying systems is that I can only think of one farmer in that time that I would categorise as if I've got a black stilt on my property, I'd shoot it. Almost all of the rest of them are quite prepared to take active measures to protect values if they are convinced they're real, and if they are working in partnership with councils rather than having regulation imposed on them. So the Kiritu method of participatory involvement of a community to achieve biodiversity outcomes of working together is not a pipe dream. The Kiritu model shows it works, and it could be a way forward that we adopt to achieve protection in Queensland Lakes. Thank you.
Cushion, please.
Thank you, Dr. Next point, question that I raised earlier in relation to could an assessment experiment be designed around the threshold that are identified in the rules 3.3.3.1 and 3.3.2? Can you see a way do that? I'm taking out, I'm largely interested in we ignore the irrigation issue. We're just solely thinking about the idea of education parents using other means. Can you see a way that you can design an experiment there that can give us an answer to that question?
I can give you an absolutely unqualified and categorical answer. It is easily possible to do both of those things, providing you have a trained professional who recognises the species. I'd make a further point that I'm talking about indigenous vascular species. If we extend the definition of indigenous species as has been proposed to include lichens and mosses, then already you're moving from identification of vascular species, which requires professional, to identification of highly specialised professionals to identify indigenous lichens and species. And the answer to that is yes, it can be done, but it's an enormous cost. So I suggest that the way forward is that we use the vascular species as the primary determinants of what constitutes indigenous biodiversity. Let's not rule out the subclass of talking in indigenous lichens or things like that, but again, we're moving from general communities down to small specified communities that identify large areas. And in direct answer to your question, ecological survey techniques have been developed to such a state that we can very easily and very accurately determine those percentage covers with the proviso, and it's an important proviso that we define what spatial scale we're operating on. If you take a scabweed that's sitting in a 1 metre by 1 metre square and the scabweed is a 1 metre radius, then there's nearly 100% of the vegetation cover or very high. If we take a 10 metre square, then that 1% becomes 1%. If we take 1,000 metres, it comes down to a certain scale of 10. The determinant of that is the nature of the community. You know, I mean, in the evidence that Alan Bars just presented, you know, when you look at those pictures, you see he talks about scrub on the hillside, and that's the natural thing that we do, or festive dancing, modified dancing. So you use the scale of those communities to determine and drive the scale. And I make the point that already the arbitrary, and I do stress that word, arbitrary definition of scale in the QLB's Queensland Lakes Plan is extremely conservative, almost to the point of being restrictive. And Alan Barr is now proposing we tighten it even further. The point I try and make with that is that what we're trying to do is draw class boundaries
and we should use the existing natural vegetation and the shape and extent of that, and there are problems with this, to determine what scale we should operate on. And we should determine that particular community that is going to be paired in that area that's going to be paired. So if, for example, to give you a concrete example, we're talking about a centre pivot, and that's the area that the vegetation clearance is being proposed for, that should define the spatial scale that we operate on. So 20% of the centre pivot, or my arguments follow, 33% or something, of that area that's going to be paired should be the determinant of that value of trees and vegetation clearance rule, rather than an arbitrary measure of 500 metres squared or something like that. But that again is a matter of how people wish to define those invested natural and easily understood concept for ordinary people. Fifthly, requirement is that you're going to specify certain areas to trigger rules, and they're in there as a specified boundary, then that needs to be looked at very carefully. And the thing that makes me extremely uneasy with what's being proposed in the plan is the arbitrariness of just selecting 500 metres or reducing it down from 5,000. Those are purely arbitrary, they're not based on any scientific or logical criteria, it's simply an arbitrary position of what someone considers to be protection. The problem is that that varies depending on the communities that we're working with. If we're working with, say, habitats for passerine birds, we need large areas because they will move from clump to clump to clump to clump. If we're dealing with individual species of, say, a particular trees such as canoe, that we're dealing on a different scale. If we're dealing with the scale for a very small and threatened rare species, then we're dealing almost on the scale of meters or very small areas. So we've got an inherent issue of scale that underlies our requirement for detection of those things. And that's why I'm uneasy about simply designating one boundary as being determinative. That's my
opinion. Thank you.
Part of the issue that we have to deal with, that Mr. Page rightly pointed out, is rules have to be easily interpreted. All that you've told us so far is, in large part, it requires expert analysis to determine the procedures and the communities involved.
No, I disagree with that statement.
So any person such as myself could walk out and work out that a 500 square metre piece of land that has 70% indigenous coverage.
What I'm talking about is an important point in Nathan's clarification, is that ordinary people can interpret and apply these rules. If, for example, we say 33%, you know, with the structural dominance, is indigenous, and you've got a chunk of Karnataka, then you do not require a PhD in ecology to be able to figure out structurally that's indigenous type, and that it's dominant, same with the tussocks. Or if we look at those modified pesky grasslands that are Alan's presented, or you can see in my evidence. Ordinary people can look at that. So most of this is a highly modified community, or most of this is exotic pasture. Where you require expert determination that farmers can't do is when you're looking at the single species or the biodiversity components of what's indigenous or not, because when you get down to the small fine things, farmers can't do that. And that's where you need expert advice to come into. But in terms of the big picture for communities, the beauty of what I'm proposing is that it's simple and ordinary farmers can understand it. And, you know, it's not particularly difficult to make those distinctions.
In Mr. Barr's protocol slide, back to you, he has, it's about the one in, and it's got the current community as a full ground area on the flat dominated by Barra, Horatio and St John's.
Sorry, but
Okay, so I'm on. Yeah, that's the foreground. That's what we're dealing
with. Still hunting for it here.
So, foreground area on flat nominated by Brian, Ray, and
that's the one here.
That's just the one here, yep.
Could we then, on that assessment, be relatively assured that there would not be indigenous plants in there that would alter that? In other words, the island plants, for instance, the difficulty determine.
The answer to that is categorical, unambiguous.
No.
Right. And if I could comment further, then this is moving us into the area of threatened species as opposed to communities. If we're looking at communities, indigenous vegetation, very clearly that's not an indigenous community.
Right.
So no one has a problem with that.
So the real issue we have that's confronting us is this issue of the threatened species, the individual 7 or 8 page list that I glanced my eyes through and none of them struck me as something that I knew. And that is that by including that the council would be creating an almost impossible task. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely, without question.
Right. But if we were to say on the basis of this, the predominant structure there are all exotic, if we took your approach to community, then it would fall into the less than 33% indigenous, if there was any there. That is what you're suggesting would make it a simple and easily understood rule, is that correct?
Yes.
Right. Good.
And I'd like to add to that, that when we come into this question of how we handle the rare and threatened in communities like that, that's a professional task that requires professional people to ascertain that. And because a community may be semi-natural or even exotic, it does not mean that does not contain, or in some cases, cannot contain individual species of extraordinarily high value. I can think of one nationally threatened orchid, and it occurs in the middle of a racecourse paddock. Now, the point there is that's 100% exotic grasses, or maybe 100%, but we have this population of this little orchid that loves it. The key thing there is it's identified, and so its management is prescribed to protect it so that it's not plowed, it's not overstowed, it's not watered, it's just mown, and it's been there and it's very happy. So in situations like that, the suggestion I would think that we follow is that first of all, people who are very competent, which is the Department of Conservation botanists, university botanists, or the council's own botanists, survey the existing protected areas in those environments for these threatened species comprehensively at the time that they can be discovered at these spring ends. Secondly, we then draw up maps of where they occur, and if, for example, we've got threatened species here, threatened species there, and a gap in between, it happens to be Mandy's farm, then we knock on Mandy's door and we say, look, we've got this little rare critter here, we've got it up here, we think it might be on your place, can we go and have a look for it? And if it's there, then we will need to have some way of looking after it or protecting it. So it might mean that Mandy's not going to irrigate the whole of that particular flat if she finds it. She might put aside a chunk of this kind of vegetation that looks after that particular species if it's found. And that's done not by the farmer, but by professionals who would then come in.
Yes,
I hope I'm not talking to you.
Yeah, no, what I'm trying to get a grip on is whether there are, ignoring whether it's of value, but whether there is any practical ability to set a rule
that the farmer would know immediately whether that is indigenous vegetation, that to clear it would require consent. And from what you said previously, we'd have to take out threatened species as a trigger, because that is not something that your average farmer would know. The question then becomes, if you take them out, in those various photos that Mr. Barr presented, and ignoring Kanu because that's so obvious that it's almost self-evident, are there other areas in there that would be indigenous vegetation that would fall into what you consider the communities for 70% or more, say, indigenous, that you could look at requiring some sort of consent to clear, that would be easily ascertainable by the farmer?
The answer to that is yes, and I'd like to give a slight comment that if we're protecting similar environments and in the same environment of the same community that are already in protected areas, it's highly likely that we're going to protect the threatened species that are present. And therefore, using the vegetation community as a, if you like, a surrogate, well, not so much a surrogate, but rather a...
an ecological hold.
What I'm trying to say is that if you've got an ecological community where these guys occur, for example, the little myosotis do not occur in peach forests, they occur in these sort of open up grasses. And if we've got protected open up grasses, then it's probable that that site would be equally possible for those threatened species to occur. And so we can achieve protection of those species by protection of the community. It's just, if you like, it's a subcomponent of the community that occurs into it. And I think that's a practical way forward.
I may not have helped you.
On the issue of irrigation, given your considerable experience in this district, do you think the design and implementation of new irrigation systems on farmland is a significant threat to indigenous biodiversity communities?
I think it's unquestionable that adding fertilizers, water, and compared to exotic species will eliminate remnant indigenous small dry grassland species. Point one. Point two, what we need to do is not ban irrigations ipso facto, but come back again to my point. We look at the vegetation and survey it to see if there are any real threats to decreasing indigenous biodiversity by the proceeding of irrigation. That means you assess the individual grassland community, because it will be a grassland community if it's being irrigated. And then you assess that with the protection that's already for that community in the local environment. And if there's adequate protection, then that becomes a reason allowing that irrigation development to occur. If the protection of that community is inadequate, in other words, there's no communities that are in that same environment or local environment, we do not need these to do that. I mean, it's just so obvious. Then we would say,
we need to survey that very thoroughly before we go ahead with the name. But what I also think is another strategy, which is present in the plan, is that if farmers are doing that, most of the farmers that I've been involved with irrigation are very open to protecting areas of that same vegetation source that are not going to be irrigated. In other words, they're not going to irrigate 100%, they will irrigate a percentage of that, but they will leave margins in the irrigation or areas alongside it for protection of those indigenous values. And I think that one of the things that wrongly assumed is that farmers are not interested in protecting values. We've made an assumption that they're only interested in making money and that they're flat out going to, you know, rape, pillage and destroy and flock and irrigate us all the way through. My own dealing with real farmers in conservation is that that's not the case. There's certainly an imperative, like with Doug Linus, to go ahead and to develop the land and produce an income from it. But equally, Dougal is quite prepared to set aside areas for conservation that it's not going to develop. And that, you know, came out on the course. And almost all the farmers I've dealt with fit that similar mold. I think it's an avenue that we should explore and explore with a participation model to achieve those biodiversity outcomes. And I know that our question has been incredibly fruitful working with farmers on private land. And I see no reason we can't succeed here.
Okay.
Right, it's a long-winded answer to your question, but I hope it's helpful.
I don't think maybe I might have confused the question a little bit by using the word threat. What I was talking about was, in terms of trends of land use change, do you think it's likely that more irrigation schemes are going to be set up where they're not currently being used throughout the district, and that indigenous biodiversity communities? Is there a need for a rule to control irrigation as a fair way of
thinking? I would suggest that the answer to that is no. We should not single out irrigation as a particular threat to changing communities, but what we should do is look at the actual communities that are going to be irrigated, or the grasslands that are going to be irrigated, and almost all of them will fall into that semi-natural category. I know of no one who's proposing to irrigate intact, pristine, short tussock grasslands in the whole of the upper Perth or Waitaki. It's almost always falling into that in-between zone. And I think that most farmers, if they're going to proceed with irrigation, and you can ask Mandy directly for a farmer's opinion on this when she talks to you, are very amenable to putting aside areas of their land that they will look after or the values that are present if they are there. Every single person, every single farmer that I've spoken to in that regard has been without question willing to do that. The key thing is it's a participation model and it involves them directly as working together. It's not a rule that's coming down from on high as it's proposed in the current plan that says you shall not be there. Have you do that, sir? It's a completely different way of approaching a problem that I think is going to be fruitful and will yield protection, and at the same time also allow development of land for farming that is not of intrinsically high conservation value. Now I stress that there are other ecologists who, being as one of them, hold with integrity a different viewpoint. They say that every single bit of the land on the developed low altitude flatland, that's where most of the vegetation has been removed, and that's the most at risk vegetation. So in their viewpoint, the threshold is right on that link, and they will protect every mouse tassel or every mouse patch of Kalinga. So many possessions, that's important. My own viewpoint is that if we look at how we resolve that tension between development and conservation, look at each piece of land that's going to be developed, look at what's protected around it, and then when we've done that, we then make decisions to what that land use should be. And I think that's the way that we should handle the irrigation rather than making blanket designation of our shop was in that.
In danger of oversimplifying the immense amount of information you've provided us, so thank you. Are you proposing that we council would undertake more significant nature areas and would go out and identify those at the broader cost to the community versus a farmer identifying a particular area that they would like to, I guess, alter land use or increase and intensify that land use, whereby they would be slightly more precautionary and carry out their own review of that land for to identify any potential significant species. So would that be correct? So you're suggesting that in fact it should be the community that or the council that goes and identifies all those species and where those areas may be significant, versus the farmer taking responsibility for their own land and taking a more precautionary approach and identify and if they think that there may be new species on that land that they would then go and carry out a review or get an ecological assessment of that land.
I think the answer is both together. The council has a responsibility to help farmers understand what might be a threatened species on their land. I'm talking about threatened species and, you know, individual small things that they can't identify. And if they think there's a possibility that they've got a threatened species or a rare species or something like that on the land, then the council identifies that, or the Department of Conservation or professionals identify those areas. Then they go and approach the farmer. And the farmer may well go and then participate in doing surveys for those species. And the farmers that I've been involved with freedom species, have done exactly that. They've come out and helped them, or they've even got their own ecologists to come in and to survey their land, alongside working together with council. So it's a together approach.
Conservation values across the community and therefore the cost should also be shared?
Yes, but I think it's quite wrong that the farmers should be asked to bear that cost entirely themselves, and I think it's also, if you like, a mandate of wise land use that incorporates conservation alongside production values that's part of the farming enterprise, and therefore they should also work collaboratively to achieve those requirements of looking after and protecting the things that the district plan is seeking to protect. And I think a lot of farmers would be very amenable to that approach. And I certainly know a lot in this district would be.
So you think
that
that sort of approach may in fact, I guess, add further protection because farmers would be more open to that collective response to these sorts of issues, as opposed to potentially, not saying that you do, but if they are unaware and likely to not want to be aware, they might actually go out and do something that has got more negative effect because they don't want to see what the outcome would be.
I think that there's two different aspects here. One is that same as what unwittingly go out and develop things because they don't understand the importance of what's there. Once farmers do understand the importance of what's there, let's say we've got a rare or slightly threatened thing or a hairy hectorite or tree daisy thing, if it's on their land, most of them are very happy to work collaboratively with Anakin and protect that or increase the population of it. For example, they won't graze or they'll set aside areas that are not going to be grazed. But what they don't like is somebody coming onto their land and saying, you've got this particular threatened species and then it must be protected and you've got to bear the cost of protection of it that's being imposed on them. That's a different model from how we achieve protection. And I think that the reality is, if farmers know what is rare and what needs protecting on their land, then they will protect it.
thank you. And if how you mentioned before in terms of the importance of I guess protecting every last individual within a protected species, for example. So your expertise would suggest that in fact if we have how would you assess the amount of area that would still need to be left to ensure the survival of the species, and that's where you're saying you need to assess every single area on its own merit to ensure for the size and the I guess use to ensure that that species survives. And just thinking back to your example of the racehorse and the orchid, so you couldn't make a rule that supports that. That's your suggestion.
I think you've got to frame a rule that achieves the protection of threatened species, but is not determinative on setting aside specific sizes. For example, to give you a real concrete example that I alluded to before, the Myosaurus minimus, the New Zealand mouse tail. The area that was set aside for protection was 1 hectare, and the actual area in which the population was occurring was of the order of perhaps 200 metres squared, and so there's a huge buffer around that. Now, in my opinion, that's perfectly adequate, and in the Department of Conservation office as well, that's perfectly adequate for protection of that species, and most importantly, the land management means that you're not going to run the power across it, you're not going to put a centrepillar irrigator across it, it's going to be maintained with a similar environment. Now that's the sort of direct thing that the farmers were very happy to collaborate with. So single species management and rare species protection doesn't require huge great chunks of areas to be set aside. I would consider that a lot of the protected areas we already we have deliberately set aside and protected areas where threatened species are known to occur. The problem here is that there's some areas where we don't know where they might occur. And that's where we need to focus on to try and look after them. And that's where I think the collaborative approach with farmers would work well. If, for example, we find a threatened species on the area that Mandy wants to put a pivot on, that right next to it we've got the same vegetation association that she's not going to irrigate because pivots go into circles, then there's no reason at all you can't set aside that area for single species management, protection of a Lepidium or a New Zealand mouse tail or something like that. And there's no reason at all you can't actively or passively manage it. In other words, you transplant individuals of that population into those areas to protect them.
So the assumption of passive management rather than active management is something we need to think about very carefully for single species conservation. And I think with that kind of approach, we will really be able to protect and achieve the vision, which is the goal of the legislation for the district, not only the communities, but also the single and new species.
Where those issues are, I guess, in a plain area, so the majority of that area that they don't want to, where an ecologist suggests that they need to protect for the particular species you're talking about, is within the area of irrigation. Do you believe that there's enough of a, that you've identified the principles on which you would have to actually go forward and create that management plan together? I'm just saying, I know that the collaborative idea is a good one. Is there already a process that you're using that you can see that DocUse or some other organisation to come up with that management plan that does give, I guess, workable results?
Yeah, thank you. Speak to that directly, this will be involved with one. This was again interesting. It was initiated by farmers, and they had rare species on the plant. This is in the Kingdom example, which they wish to irrigate. So what they are doing is that they are actively propagating and taking some of the rare species, a little crest, it's a thing called Opinion cisnebroides, it's in one of the rare species here. And they're looking at ways that they can actually propagate that species on areas they're not going to irrigate, so that if they've got a chunk of the where the centre pivot's going, then they can irrigate and propagate it outside. So that in that environment, that population is not lost. And we do have principles that we can successfully implement that down. The other point is that we need to survey the existing protected areas and the huge areas of development conservation land and identify where these things are, because they're still imperfectly known even in protected areas. And once we've done that, then we can really begin to make progress of ascertaining value that's based on real values rather than the things that possibly might be here and, you know, throw a dart backwards over our shoulder and hope we're hitting something. So if we find, for example, we've surveyed comprehensively all the protected areas in the Upper Clutha area and we have not found these species at the time when they should be there or we haven't found them, and then we find one example on Mantis Pivot, that means that Mantis Pivot now has very, very high conservation values, which he's delighted to know about. Conversely, we find that there are lots of these things in the protected area all around Mantis Pivot, and she's got one of those species on the pivot, then if we irrigate that pivot and convert it, it's not likely to result in loss. And that's a logical, sensible approach that I think would commend community acceptance. Rather than simply saying, you know, the thing might be here, therefore we've got to, you know, protect it for so factor. Again, it's coming down to that principle. We look at what's actually there, and then determine protection and vegetation clearance on the basis of what's actually there.
I've got one, I'm going for a June, for the afternoon June soon. I've just got one question that immediately follows that from what you've been discussing with National Water. And I'm just wondering, and based on your earlier comments, whether what your suggestion about the QE2 trust approach, whether you consider that maybe the Queenstown Lakes District Council could look at some similar sort of trust specific to the district, knowing that the QE2 trust is actually overwhelmed with applications nationally, and whether something similar is required at a district level to deal with some of these issues. I think it's not something that we could write in the plan, but no, we certainly comment on
it. I can certainly comment on it. QE2 is only one mechanism, and there can be many other covenant and trusts that can be used, district plan trusts, and they should be used, or Department of Conservation trusts. They use them very widely, and so QE2 is only, if you like, one cap on the ramp, and there are many other caps that we could use to achieve that. Some farmers set up their own individual conservation trusts, which they put into their farm management plans as conservation areas, which are then can be incorporated into district-wide protection, and that's done and a individual found canes, the found environmental caning that's coming on. So there's a lot of, if you like, avenues that we do. Some people may prefer a QE2, other people might like a dog cover, might prefer their own particular station protection mechanism. What matters is that the values are identified and the protection mechanisms are put in place to protect it. How those work depends on the individual person and their preference. And I think the idea of council being involved is extraordinarily helpful. I mean, the rates relief for QE2 covenants or simple practical things, if you want to fence the record off, then that will help with some of the cost of fencing. You know, there's simple things that we can do that are enormously powerful. And I think that we should explore those, because I really think, you know, I just speak categorically, we know that they work.
Okay. I will adjourn until 4 o'clock.
Is anything unfinished?
No.